Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Without putting too fine a point on it, oil. Just oil. That's the whole open. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 24th of March. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. $119. $119.02, to be precise. That is our starting point today as we dig in once again to how the Russian invasion of Ukraine is rippling out to the entire global economy. $119, you might have guessed, is the price of a barrel of Brent North Sea crude oil today, the global benchmark. And it is hitting, yes, of course, gas prices. But you know what? Gas is just the tip of the petrochemical iceberg. Think plastics, as Marketplace's Andy Euler does to get us going.
For all their environmental stigma and growing unpopularity, plastics are really good at what they do. They're lightweight, flexible, durable, and versatile. Some of them are even recyclable. And almost all of them are made from oil and natural gas. While we all may be giving up our gas guzzlers in the near future, we're not even close to giving up plastics.
Plastic production is the plan B for the fossil fuel industry.
Judith Inc. is founder and president of the nonprofit advocacy group Beyond Plastics.
They are losing market share for transportation. So the plastics industry and the chemical industry have teamed up to make sure that plastic production will be the way they make money in the future.
The International Energy Agency says that plastics and other petrochemical products will drive global oil demand to 2050. Big oil is preparing to meet that demand, and not just here in the U.S. Rachel Meidel is an energy and environmental fellow at Rice University in Houston.
China has more than $100 billion invested in crude to chemical projects over the next 5 years. And, you know, the oil industry in general is looking more to chemicals for diversification.
When the price of oil and natural gas goes up, so does the price of plastic. Tom Sanzillo at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says, in the short term, companies that use plastics will try to manage how much they're using and probably just eat the additional cost.
But as the cost stay higher for longer, there's no place else to go but to pass it along to the consumers. And then that risks what's called demand destruction, the people's unwillingness to pay the price. And so they may go looking for other things.
But there still aren't a whole lot of alternatives. We could recycle more, but we don't. Less than 10% of all plastic ever made has been recycled. The rest of it is trashed. Rachel Meidel at Rice says that's because even when the price of oil and gas spikes, it's still cheaper to produce virgin plastic than recycle what we have.
It's not so easy to just say that, you know, we're going to make recycled plastics, and that's because there's a cost associated with that.
She says consumer behavior will drive some change, especially in Europe and the U.S. Think reusable water bottles and compostable food containers. But when we're talking about plastics, we're not just talking about bags and packaging. Our smartphones are full of them. And the transition to a renewable energy future depends on them, too.
You know, all of the things that we say we want to do with electric vehicles and solar panels and wind turbines, they all require hydrocarbon inputs.
Meidel says we got to understand all the places that plastics and therefore fossil fuels touch our lives if we're ever going to transition away from them. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not much transitioning going on at all. Up one day, up the next day, and oh look, up again the next. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Thank you.
Cybersecurity has been in the news this week. President Biden's been talking about it in the context of Russian sanctions reprisals. The White House has briefed corporate CEOs about it, and a lot of the concern, which makes sense, has been about infrastructure, communications, technology, electricity, those kinds of things. But pretty much every industry and every company right now has some kind of cyber vulnerability, even if they don't know it, which is why the American shortage of cybersecurity professionals is kind of a problem, as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino tells us.
There are about 400,000 unfilled positions in cybersecurity in the U.S., according to the trade group ISC Squared. And that's likely an undercount, says CEO Claire Rosso.
And that is only the organizations that have prioritized cybersecurity staff.
Many companies, particularly small and medium-sized ones, still don't know what they don't know. Almost half of companies don't have a dedicated chief information security officer, according to a report from IT service firm Navisight. And they can be tough to hire, says Todd Thibodeau at the Computer Technology Industry Association.
They're probably already working for other people. So if you can't find one in the market, nurture somebody on your team into that role.
He says people in other tech leadership roles can be trained on cybersecurity fundamentals through certification programs. But first, company boards need to step up, says Friso Wunderords with the National Association of Corporate Directors.
Boards should be comfortable challenging management on how well this particular risk area is managed.
But he says only 4% of directors for the biggest U.S. companies in the Russell 3000 Index have the cybersecurity expertise needed to do that.
That's an enormous gap.
This week, the Securities and Exchange Commission proposed a new set of rules that would require public companies to disclose whether they have cybersecurity experts on their boards and what their strategies are to manage the risks. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
According to the Federal Reserve, total student loan debt in this country stands at just over $1.7 trillion. Since the pandemic started, borrowers whose loans are owned by the federal government haven't had to make payments. That moratorium is set to expire on May the 1st. Thus, a report out this week from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York becomes all the more relevant, as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports.
The federal government has been playing a game of kick the can with student loans. One of the reasons the game has lasted 2 years is that it's going to be painful to stop. Daniel Mangrum is an economist at the New York Fed and one of the authors of that new report.
This is a monumental task to restart payments for 37 million borrowers. Millions of them have never made a payment because they graduated during the pandemic and have never had to make a payment before.
Easing people into that will be hard. But if you look at this through the lens of another game, hot potato, the potato being the debt, it's the government that's losing.
85% of all outstanding balances are owned by the federal government. So essentially, this is kind of increasing the cost of the federal student loan program.
The Fed estimates the government held off on collecting $195 billion over the course of the pandemic and also missed out on interest payments. Mark Goldwine is with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. He says it's time for the government to declare victory, take its potato, and go home.
Right now, the employment situation for college graduates is actually quite strong. And the idea that we should still be giving them emergency relief doesn't really make much sense.
Others, like Dalia Jimenez, who directs the Student Loan Law Initiative at the University of California, Irvine, say the loans should be erased altogether, or not even be needed in the first place. She believes college should cost less.
The answer is to allow people to continue their education and to do it without having to bankrupt themselves.
Especially, she says, if more jobs require college degrees. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Rural hospitals in this healthcare economy have been in trouble for a while, years, really, even before the pandemic. And it's gotten so bad after 2 years of the virus that some of them are now practically being given away to investors who say they can make those hospitals profitable again. From WPLN, Blake Farmer reports on the rural hospital resurrection business.
I get the idea Kyle Kopech enjoys giving tours of the rundown hospitals his company is snapping up. This one is in Aaron, Tennessee, about 90 minutes from Nashville.
Just don't trip on this right here.
In the attic, Kopech points out problems left by the last company, like expired supplies, and a newly renovated emergency room with doors too narrow for a gurney.
If you'd like, we can try and wheel that bed through and see kind of what happens.
An old operating room is temporarily housing the ER while Kopech's company, Braden Health, works on renovations. Kopech bounces through the halls, greeting nurses and clerical staff by name. He has a confidence that belies his age and experience. He's just 22, but leading the acquisition of businesses that are critical to these towns, the local hospital.
They're not the most complicated things in the world, but if you don't know exactly how to run them, you're just going to run them straight into the ground.
And the mayor of Houston County, James Bridges, agrees.
We had no business being in the hospital business. The majority of county governments do not have the expertise and the education and knowledge that it takes to run healthcare facilities in 2022.
Those with the most experience, like big corporate hospital chains based nearby in Nashville, have been getting out of the small hospital business too. So communities have seen a revolving door of managers. Some even got in trouble for shady billing practices. In nearby Decatur County, where Braden Health is also taking over, the previous operator has been indicted on theft charges. Lori Brasher sits on the Decatur County Economic Development Board.
You're looking to someone who supposedly knows what to do, who can solve the issue, and you trust them. And then you're disappointed, and not disappointed once, but disappointed multiple times.
Brasher says she has much more confidence in Braden Health, though local residents still have trouble stomaching the sticker price. Decatur County agreed to sell its hospital for $100. Houston County was just $1. Braden Health says hospital cleanup and renovations will cost millions. At Decatur County General, abandoned by the former owner 2 years ago, Kopech unlocks the walk-in freezer.
If you look at the bottom, those are a bunch of dead maggots that didn't make it out.
And as part of these deals, Braden Health does commit to upgrades. And most of that is funded by the company's founder, Dr. Bo Braden.
I understand that perspective that a lot of people would have that would think that it's worth a lot more. But if you look honestly at a lot of the transactions that take place with rural hospitals and how many liabilities are tied up with them right now, there's really not a lot of value there.
Braden is an emergency physician who was trying to build a new hospital in Southwest Florida, where he owns a large rural clinic. But after running into regulatory roadblocks, he saw more opportunity reopening hospitals, which brought him to Tennessee with a lot of closed and distressed hospitals. Braden's aiming to build a mini network that could share staff and supplies as needed. Braden says he can understand any skepticism, even from the employees. These aren't the first turnaround promises Jennifer Warren has heard. She's the facilities manager at the Houston County Hospital.
Don't get me wrong. I know that the citizens, and I even was one of them, that didn't want to come here because it was going down. But the fact of it is, my mind has been changing.
It didn't take much. Under a previous company, Warren was told they didn't have the money to buy tools as simple as a sander. Now she's got a budget to make the hospital a place where she and others would actually want to be treated. In Aaron, Tennessee, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
they spend around $65 million a year.
The Oscars are coming up this weekend, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Ooh, the sad happy. Dow Industrials 349 to the good today. 1%, 34,707. The NASDAQ picked up 269 points, 1.9%, 14,191. The S&P 500 added 63 points, about 1.4%, 45.20 there. More than a quarter of $1 million. That's the average bonus paid to Wall Street finance types last year. Comes to us from the New York State Comptroller, Thomas DiNapoli. To be precise, it's $257,500 as a bonus. That's a record, also 20% higher than last year's average bonus, which was also a record. Needless to say, if you've been paying attention on this program, you know that's about four times the median household income in this country in 2020. Electric truck maker Nikola jumped about 5 7/10% today after announcing that earlier this week it had started up its production lines for the first time. That's a big deal. A lot of people have been watching that. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.36%. You're listening to MarketPlace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We mentioned Monday, I think it was, that Fed Chair Jay Powell had done a speech and a Q&A at the annual conference for the National Association for Business Economics, where he said, as we told you on Monday, that there is nothing standing in the way of the Fed raising interest rates half a percentage point at its next meeting. It was a quarter point hike last week. You remember that. There was, though, something else Powell said that caught our ear.
So, of course, it is real rates that matter in the end. And, you know, we're very focused on that.
Real rates, real interest rates. That's what you get when the rates you see on a loan or on a credit card, that's called the nominal rate. Then you factor in what inflation is going to do to that rate over time.
Let's take a simple example, okay?
Simple examples, definitely okay. Economist Natasa Zervo is at the University of Texas, Austin. Here's the example. Let's say we buy a bond paying 6% interest.
Of course, with these days' rates, good luck with that. I mean, that's not going to be 6%. It's going to be much lower. But this is an example, okay?
Yes, okay.
If inflation is expected to increase, let's say, by 5% within that year, then what you only going to have back from this yearly investment on the bond, it's going to be 1%.
6% interest minus 5% inflation, you are left with a real rate of 1%, right? Actual inflation right now, as we all know, is way higher than 5%. Nominal interest rates, as we also all know, are way lower than 6%, which means the real rate, interest minus inflation again, is even lower. So there's not a whole lot of incentive for people to save money, that is to say not spend, which has to happen if the Fed's going to get inflation under control.
That's why the Fed's actions right now really matter, because they try to anchor these inflation expectations and convince the public that, yes, inflation is high, but we are after that and we are going to take care of that.
Hence Powell saying on Monday, yeah, maybe we could do a 0.5%. Who knows? Thanks again to Natasa Zervo. She's at the University of Texas, Austin. You've heard of the idea of a digital wallet, yes? A place, usually your phone, where you can keep credit cards and debit cards and gift cards, tickets, that kind of stuff. Till now, though, there has been something missing from that list, a truly digital ID card. We are, however, a step closer today. Apple has announced its devotees in Arizona can now store their driver's licenses on their phones. More states coming soon. The company does say that people ought to carry their physical IDs for now. The only airport that accepts the digital version at the moment is Phoenix. But as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports, this has a whole lot of implications for how we prove our identities and spend our money.
I recently downgraded my wallet from an unwieldy George Costanza situation to a sleek card case because I can do a lot with my phone. Pay for groceries, take the New York City subway, show proof of COVID vaccination. Only thing missing is my ID.
The day is almost here when practically every transaction can all be managed through your smartphone.
Ishwar Prasad is the author of The Future of Money. He says true digital wallet adoption is just a few years away.
Apple wants to make sure that it plays a central role between consumers, businesses, and the government.
Consumers, businesses, and the government. Akif Khan, an analyst at Gartner, says they have a stake in digital IDs too.
Imagine you're buying alcohol online.
Online gambling is another one. You don't need to prove your identity necessarily, but you need to prove your age.
He says this is where digital wallets are headed. In Sweden, the Bank ID app is a popular way for people to pay for stuff and sign loan documents and tax returns. But it'll take some coordination in the U.S. There are 50 states, each with its own ID laws, and many tech companies are developing these features, which could make adoption clunky for businesses.
You're potentially going to have to be accepting 5, 10, 15, 20 different digital identity wallets in order to not exclude any customers.
Those customers need persuading, too. Americans have been slower to adopt mobile wallets than people in many other parts of the world. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
All right, here comes this weekend's news today. Not who is going to win at the Academy Awards on Sunday, but how the corporate finance behind them works. We probably don't have to tell you, right, that the ratings for the Oscars broadcasts have been lousy for a while now, record low last year. You roll that in with the news the Academy is going to cut 8 awards categories from the telecast, and things would seem to be not great, perhaps, for the Academy. That would be the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Turns out, though, maybe they're doing all right. So says Walt Hickey. He's a senior editor for Data at Insider, also runs the Substacks Numlock News and Numlock Awards. Walt, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Everybody knows the Oscars, right? Probably not so many people know exactly what the Academy is or does. Give us the thumbnail sketch, would you?
Of course. So the Academy is the organization behind the Academy Awards. They're a rapidly growing organization of professionals who work in the movie business, actors, directors, craftsmen, folks like that. They've increased from about 6,000 people about 10 years ago to 10,000 today. That transformation has really made it interesting in terms of who wins Academy Awards, how they vote, and all that kind of stuff.
The who wins Academy Awards thing is the topic for another interview, which maybe we'll do at some point in front of next year's Oscars. But I wanted to talk to you about the work you have done on the Academy's balance sheet and its business prospects, because it is, for all the wailing and gnashing of teeth in Hollywood about the Academy on many legitimate levels, it is just super strong now business-wise.
Yeah, I was really impressed and kind of surprised by this, honestly. So for those who haven't kind of followed this, there's been a couple lines on the Academy. One has been they've built this massive museum in the center of Los Angeles. Some consider this kind of an albatross around their neck. It's just, why did they spend so much money building this thing? And then the other thing that you always talk about is ABC is always breathing down their neck to get the ratings up. And so there's been this kind of sense of tension. But, you know, I wanted to find out exactly where that tension was coming from. And so I actually went to their balance sheet over the past 10 years or so. And I was thoroughly impressed as to where they're standing now. And I think that this is an organization that's transformed itself from kind of a year-to-year production company that puts on a nice show to an actual institution with a billion-dollar endowment and ways to really kind of make a permanent legacy.
How did they do this?
Yeah, this is a really good question. So here's the basics of the Academy, right? The Academy spends about $38 million every year putting the Oscars on. And then they also spend a bunch of money on the library that they run and the organization that they run, to the point that they spend around $65 million a year. Mm-hmm. That's good because ABC pays them a certain amount of money every year, around $130 million, and they make money every year. And what's really interesting is that they've been plowing this money into an investment firm, into an investment fund, I should say. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, they have built a war chest of, you know, something like $1.4 billion in a combination of that property and that just investment fund.
Am I going too far if I say that they maybe don't need ABC and the Oscars telecast to maintain? Look, they need it for publicity and all that jazz, but for their business purposes and what they do the 364 days of the year that are not the Oscars, do they need that television show?
Yeah, I love this angle because, like, we're not there yet, but that, I think, is the goal. I think that this organization wants to function like a university where, listen, if the university doesn't get the big ESPN sports contract every year, you know, they're sitting on an endowment that will ensure they'll be able to open their doors next year. And what this looks to me is cord-cutting proof the Academy, making it so that even if the bottom falls out on network television, they are able to persist in some capacity. And also, maybe if ABC has to shave a few points off the top, where can you make that money back? Well, plug in your museum. You're now a destination that you have an opportunity to pitch out to one of the largest audiences in American television.
All right, last thing, since I have you on and since we got to talk about the awards at least to some degree, who do you like for Best Picture? And the way I follow this now, it's Coda or Power of the Dog. You got a favorite?
You nailed it. Yeah, no, I mean, I like both of those movies a lot. I liked a couple of the other ones, too. I like Licorice Pizza. I love Dune. But I think that this year it might be Coda. Power of the Dog, I think, kind of has the edge. They're going in the front runner. But this is going to be a great race this year. We are not going to know who wins Best Picture until the last few minutes of the Academy Awards. And I for one, am thrilled for that.
All right, let me just say, Power of the Dog, not my favorite. Don't at me, but it didn't do it for me. All right, anyway, Walt Hickey, he runs a couple of Substacks, a couple of newsletters. One is Numlock. The other one is Numlock Awards. Both of them are super fascinating. Check it out. Senior editor for data at Insider for his day job. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that it is Thursday, which means we got the weekly report on first-time claims for unemployment benefits today. And I am pleased to be able to tell you that we are back in, yeah, that's not such an important indicator territory, just like we were in the before times. Of course, once the pandemic hit and those claims climbed into the millions and millions, we spent a lot of time on them. Last week, just 187,000 people filed first-time claims for jobless benefits. That is the lowest since 1969. All right, we got to go. Once again, too much me talking. Not enough time. No moment of economic context today. My apologies. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.